Amory and 107.5 FM W298DK Amory. And always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Dave Packer. Siren sounded in Tel Aviv today as the city came under a Hamas rocket attack. Police say four girls between the ages of 9 and 17 watching a movie Saturday evening at an AMC theater in Braintree, Massachusetts, when a man wearing a blonde wig rushed into the theater without paying, stabbed the girls without warning. Witness Mateo Rojas.
They were in a daze, needless to say, very traumatized and definitely wanted to have their privacy head down, but at least they were talking and were engaged with the EMT, so that was relieving to see.
The suspect in custody may be linked to two stabbings at a McDonald's in Plymouth, Massachusetts, and a homicide in Connecticut. Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has accepted a nomination to be among those vying to be the Libertarian Party's presidential candidate, who will be chosen this afternoon at the Libertarian National Convention in Washington. A day after the PGA Tour announced that 30-year-old golfer Grayson Murray died, his family announcing the cause of death, suicide. This is ABC News. Storms in the Midwest have delayed the start of this year's Indy 500.
The 108th running of the Indianapolis 500 will begin with a rain delay. Track president Doug Bowles saying they will clear the grandstands here at the Speedway due to lightning concerns. He says there's about 125,000 people already on the track property. Once the storm moves through, he's anticipating they'll be able to start drying the 2.5-mile oval sometime in the 3 o'clock hour at the Indianapolis 500. Will Clark, ABC News.
Bears breaking into homes and cars in Southern California looking for a snack in Monrovia. Vina Corey says a bear broke into her garage and rummaged through her refrigerator to get cake that was inside.
Ate the entire cake. Like, there was no mess around. He did not leave anything. He licked all the crumbs out of the box, but he left the candle, and I thought that was very smart.
Last week, a much smaller bear broke into the car, took groceries, Oreos, too. Dave Packer, ABC News.
This Memorial weekend, we pause to remember the brave souls who gave everything for our freedom. Their courage and selflessness will forever be etched in our hearts and in the fabric of our nation. Their legacy of bravery and dedication will continue to inspire us for generations to come. For those who gave their all for us, we are forever grateful. Brought to you by the Squeegee Squad, your neighborhood window cleaner. Learn about their services and story at squeegeesquad.com or give them a call at 715-255-0770.
I'm James Kelly with WLAK News. Your news roundup in quick podcast form. Find it anytime on the WLAK website at lakeair.radio.
The Todd Alba Show.
The fantastic Jane Matt Nair of Matt Nair on Air. I'm a big fan of like the Rose Bowl, the Orange Bowl, the Cotton Bowl. Well, now from Snoop Dogg, they're going to have the Snoop Bowl, the Snoop Bowl. How about that, Jane?
I think we're missing the obvious. Where's the Punch Bowl? Where's the Toilet Bowl? I think that there are other bowls that are being neglected.
I think it could maybe be the Snooper Bowl, though.
The Todd Alba Show. Weekdays, noon till 2 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. Avian flu is jumping from birds to dairy cattle around the country. So far, it's not turned up in Wisconsin, but experts are being vigilant. Mike Moan has more.
Bird flu has been detected in dairy cows in several other states. And in Texas, a man is known to have become ill with bird flu last month after contact with infected dairy cattle. And that worries Andrew Pecos with the Johns Hopkins School of Public Health.
Given that dairy farms have a large number of people who can come in contact with infected cows, there is an increased chance of the H5N1 virus also directly infecting humans and beginning that process of adapting to replication and spread within humans themselves.
He says the risk to the general public is still very low, but the U.S. should improve its response to new and emerging infections to minimize the chance of another pandemic. The U.S. Department of Agriculture recently announced it will pay dairy farms with confirmed avian flu infections to help contain the virus's spread to people and more cows. In Texas, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention confirmed the virus killed a dozen cats who drank raw cow's milk. Megan Davis, also with Johns Hopkins, believes it's safe to eat poultry and drink milk, with one exception.
Raw milk and raw milk products may not undergo the same processes to inactivate the virus. And so I have very large concerns about the safety of raw milk.
To date, federal officials only mandate testing for dairy cows moving between states. Wisconsin has long embraced its reputation as a milk-producing state In most rankings, it only trails California in this category. This is Mike Moen for Wisconsin News Connection. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell.
This is your hometown radio, Refreshed, keeping you informed, entertained, and connected locally across the Civic Media Network.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. We'll see some shower chances for today. There could be some heavy rainfall at spots. Otherwise, we'll see highs in the lower 60s. Southeast winds will turn to the northeast. Tonight, skies will turn mostly clear, lows dropping to the upper 40s. Right now, it's 58.
John Mino and Jim Schmidt.
Enjoy the holiday. On Tuesday's show, Johnny's back, and we'll feature Ariel Perez from the Green Bay Press-Gazette, Malane Wells from WFRV-TV, plus we'll be talking the Green Bay Rockers. See you then.
Mino and the Mayor, weekday mornings 6 till 9. This is Lake Air 1260 AM WLAK.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Folks, we got a new episode of the Cripes Cast with me, Charlie Behrens. Enjoy this episode with Top Chef winner turned host, Kristen Kish. Hello. How you been?
I've been good. How are you?
I am great. It was fun seeing that episode. I thought it turned out really good.
I mean, I wish all of your quick wit and all the one-offs that we had on you made it in there. However, we all know sitting at that table what it was like. It was awesome.
You're too kind. It was super fun to be there, though. It really was.
Did you ever watch Top Chef or no?
So I had watched like a couple episodes of Top Chef, but yeah. Since, you know, I got lucky enough to be in the situation, I kind of went back through. I mean, I've watched this season, which has been really, really fun, and went back and watched other seasons, watched a bunch of stuff from when you were on and when you won in 2012. So, you know, what I'm like, just laying the groundwork for the audience, when it comes to food, I'm very much so like, if I've killed it, I've probably grilled it. But aside for that, not a lot of experience with cooking outside of like fish, deer, turkey, that kind of, like, I haven't done much and I don't understand. But then like watching Top Chef, you get the stories behind the food. And I think it's like a different entry point for someone, because I'm one of 12 kids. We didn't grow up going out. So we kind of have whatever my mom was making, which was always great. But it's not like I ever had a choice in food, so I never thought about it. So that translated to adulthood. And it's kind of like just something that you're not included in a little. And so you're just like, yeah, whatever it is great. All that said, super fun this season of Top Chef, because I'm learning about Wisconsin, things I didn't know. And I've lived here forever, my whole life, aside for 10 years I left. And I'm learning how that intertwines with the food. And kudos to you. You do such an amazing job hosting the show. How did it feel after having the first season done, having it roll out now? How does it all feel?
I mean, it was, I will say, from the first episode to the last episode, you got me on episode 2, which,
oh, wow,
which was good, because I did realize that like my nerves dropped from episode 1 to episode 2. But I know, I think just internally, it was my own pressure that I was putting on myself to like be great at this job, when I just needed to like be me, and those who liked me are going to like me, and those who don't, and that's okay. It's not my responsibility to appeal to everybody, and the people that I do will enjoy it. And that's cool.
Yeah.
You got me on episode 2. I was feeling good. I liked my clothes. I felt real good. And we had a big table. I will say, out of a lot of the group dinners that we have each episode, this one flowed in a way that is really hard to describe. It felt like as if the cameras weren't there. Like it was, I didn't have to call on people to talk. Everyone was just kind of talking, but respecting the space between everyone's words. And it felt really good. And that gave me confidence.
You know what? I got to say, as someone who did a little hosting before I did stand up and comedy and all that. And anytime there is a table panel show that I audition for or whatever, it was just like, all right, get ready, because you're going to go in there and no one's going to listen to each other. Everyone's going to scream over each other, try to get that main hosting gig. And it's just going to be like really bad improv. But I agree with you. It was super cool that you know, you had experts, people who owned restaurants, all that stuff, me for whatever reason, but people were listening and chiming in, and the food was incredible. So it was just a very special thing. I also have to say, it's such a treat for me being a Milwaukee guy going to the beer caves. I didn't really know the extent to I had heard those were there, but that was such a cool experience. How did you like eating in those caves?
I think the beauty of Top Chef, I've had now a season of cooking on Top Chef and a season of hosting on Top Chef, and being able to cook in so many different cool locations and present your food and draw inspiration and get excited about where you're cooking, which is likely a place you'll never really cook again unless you're invited back post Top Chef. It's the same feeling that I had from cooking to hosting. Every location we went to, when we stepped into those beer caves, I was like, holy shit. Who knew this was down here? Who knew that we could sit here and have a meal together? It was so cool. It was, you know, there's rarely a time that we go to a location, even within the Top Chef kitchen, that you're not surprised or in awe by the fact of like, we're about to eat an awesome meal made by great chefs in this really cool place. Like, how do you not get excited about that?
Yeah, no, and I love just the story. I mean, I guess going back to like what I am at the core of what I do is sort of writing. And so when I hear the stories behind the food, and Top Chef does such an amazing job with each individual contestant telling their story and how that seeps into their food to the location. I mean, it's just a different way of telling a story, which I know everybody's like, yeah, obviously, Charlie, but I'm just getting to the party on this. So it's really cool. And I, you know, I'm kind of saying that because I know there are a bunch of other people like, I don't care about fancy food, but it's just cool to see the stories that are told. You as a host, you brought this up before. You said some people are not going to like you. Some people are going to like you. That's kind of and then making it like it is your job here. I heard you say on another interview that you were told just go out there and act like you're talking to, you know, the folks at your kitchen. Mm-hmm. And when you were kind of in that mindset, you were sort of free to see it in a certain way. Did that continue to be the case? Did that continue to be the thing that got you through the first season? Or did you find other things that you brought and added on to that, making your hosting experience what it was?
You know, I think that when someone holds a position for so long, the expectation from the viewers, and even I will say it was like the first thing in my brain, I was like, well, am I supposed to do what Padma did? And I can't really pinpoint what she did. She was just doing what she does. And to go in there and have the entry level point of being like, okay, well, there's a lot more similarities than there are differences than my real life of like kitchens, talking to, you know, cooks and restaurant people and delivering dishes or whatever, and hosting, there's a lot of similarities between these two things. I talk about what I know. I ask questions on the things that I don't know. I have no ego in that respect. Like, if I don't know what you're doing or I've never heard of that dish, I'm going to ask you, what do you mean by that? And a natural curiosity for people. And so those things that I come to the table with, and everything else will start to define itself. That will be my hosting role defining, whether that changes from episode to episode or whether that remains consistent all the way through. You know, I always keep saying I didn't have to be the host of Top Chef. I am, and whatever all that means, like judges table, you know, making sure I had sweatpants because I wanted to be comfortable so I could actually think and be present in the moment, or bet you didn't know that my pants were unbuckled when we were sitting next to each other eating dinner.
Yours too? You got to be kidding me. Wow.
I got to say, you, I think maybe were the only person, and there are a lot of chefs at that point, episode two.
Yeah.
You ate everything, which loved so much. You were just like soaking and eating it all in, literally and figuratively.
It was so good. Plus, I'm a member of the Clean Plate Club, which I think I told you. But I mean, yeah, that was great food. Plus, I hadn't eaten that day because I knew I was going to, you know, get after it. So, it was all really good. Even the stuff that you guys were like, it's not so good. I could kind of taste that, but it was only retroactively could I taste that. was like, yeah, that makes sense. I'll go with that. You know,
I will say that day there weren't any bad dishes. Right.
Okay.
And the beauty of Top Chef is you're starting with a playing level and playing field of chefs that are like here.
Yeah.
And it's about who can go above that and then who maybe just kind of stays at like the good level. Right. And then who is exceptional. And so the baseline isn't bad food. The baseline is really good food. But it's then, you know, obviously our jobs to determine through technique. And if you nail the challenge, who rises above, because when you taste a dish and you know a lot about cooking and food or whatever, within the first couple of bites, you can tell if something is technically wrong. And that oftentimes will weed out a lot of stuff, because at the beginning mistakes are made and that's okay. But technically speaking, you know, immediately if a dish kind of went sideways.
I see. Okay. Yeah. That's sort of like a whole new realm of things that I don't quite see yet, but it's cool to hear. It's cool to hear it explained, you know? And that's why it's fun watching the show. And I've found, in doing it is you are kind of thinking, you're just thinking differently and it's fun. Is there a dish like the Supper Club episode I thought was super fun? Had you, being in Michigan, gone to like a Supper Club? Because I grew up with Supper Clubs. I was like, yeah, they're kind of everywhere. And then it was only later in life. I'm like, oh, this is mostly in Wisconsin. But I think there might be a few things, a few of them outside of Wisconsin. But
I had never been. I've been to like restaurants that, you know, start, you know, early in the evening with cocktails and bites. And you move into like this preset meal. And then you move into like after dinner drinks. And then you move into like live entertainment. I've been to that. So in a very broad definition, that's kind of a supper club with a little bit more specifics.
Yeah.
I know that we test the chefs with giving us a supper club. However, I would like to go back and experience a supper club from a supper club that has been around for, you know, ages.
Right. That's really the best. Cause you can just tell, you can smell in the carpeting, like this thing probably flooded at one point, you know? And you got the fake wooden walls. The bar is like never been renovated. It's usually like a circular kind of vibe. So yeah, super fun. Well, if you ever want to go to one, you find yourself in Wisconsin, let me know.
I will.
We'll make it
happen. I would love to dine with you.
Hey, let's make it happen. Where do you live these days? Where are you living?
We're on the East Coast, just outside of New York. So we were living in Manhattan, moved during the pandemic because we wanted more space. But my restaurant is in Austin, Texas.
Yeah. So how does that whole thing work?
I lived in Austin for 2 years to get it going. And the beauty of this part of my life is that I can openly say I don't want to spend 80 hours in a restaurant anymore. And I've carved out a path where I don't have to.
Yeah.
And so with opening in Austin, a place that I had never been before, I went in there and my very first hire, I was very honest with him. And I said, listen, I'm not going to be here forever. I'm going to live here for 2 years. I'm going to get you up to speed. I'm going to teach you everything that I have to teach you. And then it is your responsibility to carry it on a daily basis. And so that conversation happened. And almost six years later, he's still there running as my executive chef.
That's really cool. I mean, that's a tough thing to do. You know, it's tough to, leave your baby like that too in a lot of ways.
But you also learn that with it, when you relinquish that control and you know you've done what you needed to do, it's the same way that people did that for me, where then I could find my next stage in life, my next level of running something. You know, I have been mentored by many, and I hope that I continue mentoring others. And I feel like that is the natural progression of being able to do what I do and what my career path looks like now.
Yeah. I mean, it's sort of when you put trust in somebody else after teaching them all you can, seeing where they take it, that's almost the fun thing for you and also the lack of ego that, like, it's possible you could do something I never even imagined, which is fun to see.
The restaurant is better than when I opened it. And that is the greatest feeling ever. And they don't need me there. I go and I do my visits and menu tastings and all that kind of stuff. And like, what can I do? Like, yeah. Do you guys need my help? Or like, I want to be wanted and needed. And they're like, no, we got it. Like, go talk to guests or something.
Yeah. You've been pushed out into the dining yes. hall.
They're like, why are you taking up real estate in this kitchen?
No. Now, you've talked about how you've put kindness as sort of a priority in your kitchens. Mm-hmm. And why was that such a big thing for you to do? Even though that's kind of a weird question, but why would you take it upon yourself to change that culture and also think it would work?
I will say a lot of my career, I didn't have to deal with so much of like the bad. I had to deal with, God, a lot of egos, which was tough, very challenging, even when I was in the top position. And I realized that when I was in those positions, there was one particular job that really changed the course for me. Is I was the boss, but there are majority of people didn't want to see me in that position. Somebody else wanted it, which then that somebody else sprinkled around like toxic behavior and just kind of made my day-to-day life unpleasant, where you're just like not excited to be around the people anymore. You're just like, I got to go to work. I love doing the thing, but I hate doing the thing with these people. Yeah. And what it made me realize is none of them were mean at all. They just weren't kind. And what I did was I was nice back to them because I didn't want to rock the boat. And so going into Arlo Gray, which was 4 years later, I grew, I matured, I figured out what I wanted and what I didn't want. That there is a way of leading those who want to be led. Because if you don't want to be led, God, it's like an uphill battle. But those who want to be led, you can hold them accountable. You can reprimand. You can write them up if they do something that they shouldn't be doing. You can celebrate and you can do all those things simultaneously by simply being kind. It is the intent in which you're saying and how you say it. Nothing is a personal attack. No one is not skilled. You're just maybe not doing it the right way for right now. And with that lens, I wish someone had led me that way. I think I would have learned a lot more and I think I would have been a lot less angry, you know, but I think it's the only sustainable way to run a business. Like we all know when you go into a room, kitchen, a comedy set, whatever, when there's like one person that just throws everything off and they're not technically doing anything wrong, that energy is what you have to stop in a kitchen because otherwise it just spirals.
Yeah. Yeah. No, 1,000%. I mean, it happens on movie sets and it happens like in really every business, I'm sure, you know. What are like challenges to getting people to all act in this way? Because, you know, like once you're out of the room, they can just do whatever they want. They can act however they want. So how do you sort of go kindness first, but also maintain sort of that respect, if you will?
I think once you put your boundaries in place, whether you're the leader or an hourly employee, it doesn't matter. Once every single person kind of has their understanding of what they want to feel like and what they won't tolerate, the people that try to push those walls and push those boundaries and try to like become, well, that become kind of like this moldy spot in the kitchen, they're going to weed themselves out. But it's like, if you don't want to be here, you don't have to be here. I can find you another cook job in a week.
Right.
Like, I don't want you to be miserable.
Right. Sort of almost like saying, yeah, if right. Like even being kind to the people, not being kind of saying,
what can I do for you for your life to be happier? What can I do? I will do that. Everyone's got a story. Everyone's got a backstory. Everyone has reasons on why they are who they are. And if I like, you know, it's, you say it all the time. You don't know what someone's going through when they're being a shitty person at work. So like lead with kindness. You don't have to allow that behavior, but you can, you know, you don't have to be an asshole back.
Right.
Unless you're a complete dick.
You. There are certain times where you just got to be a human back. But I do think that, you know, I mean, it is sort of that, it's like the Midwest nice thing too, which like I make a lot of jokes about, but I feel like the more empathy we give others, the more it softens theirs, especially like politically we're so, and have been for years, just locked in this TIFF stuff online, but you get in person with people, largely that kindness is there, unless you're in some sort of political event where you have a rally and people are, but mostly people are yelling and shouting because someone's holding a phone up, you know?
Right.
So it's cool to see you actively like showing an alternative way of doing things.
But also really exhausting to be an asshole.
So exhausting. Yeah, you got to wake up every day and choose to be that asshole.
Correct.
You gotta like some mornings you wake up happy, whether you want to or not.
Yeah.
You gotta look in your mirror and be like, huh, this place, you know? We all know people who have done that, you know.
Yeah.
How much of your food do you think is inspired by your identity as a Midwesterner, your Korean roots? Like how much of that seeps into your recipes and your creative process when it comes to food?
It is a combination of a lot of different things in my life, from childhood to adulthood, travels or growing up in Michigan. But so much of my food, I try to tap into why it brought me comfort. So the things that really stick with me, largely a lot of shit that I grew up on, from a box and meatloaf and potatoes, like baked potatoes, meatloaf, and a ton of ketchup with sour cream and dried chives was like every Friday night. I love it to this day. And so if I can tap into why that brought me comfort, it's not going to show on the plate as meatloaf, but like, what is it? It's like, it's meaty, it's salty, it's savory. You have this ketchup that is adding this balance to this loaf of meat. You have a baked potato with fat and cream on top of it. And a contrast of chives. Like when I think about what that meal is and how it tastes, I can make that into something else, which is worthy of charging money for. And if I can tap into my comfort, we are connected so deeply by food, no matter where you come from. There are comfort dishes of noodles all over the country, of stews and porridges, roasts, different things. I'm likely to tap into something that maybe is a little bit familiar to you. So it doesn't feel like it's coming out of left field. I am not one of those chefs that is trying to, you know, create a dish for shock value. There are great people that know how to do that. I'm just trying to bring a little bit of comfort.
I love that. So you take the elements of your comfort food growing up and you essentially apply that to, would you say every dish you make or most dishes you make?
The majority. If I have to pull inspiration, if someone's like, create 10 dishes right now, I'm likely going to go to that place. You know, from there, it might go through edit after edit after edit and kind of become a little bit more far departed. But for me, that is where I like to start.
Yeah, that's really cool to hear. What was your journey to becoming a chef? Like, was it something you wanted to do as a kid? Is it something that you just found later on in life? How did it all happen?
It kind of all happened. Like, you know, you hear a lot of chefs that are like, oh, I've known since I was a kid. I grew up just like stirring the sauce over my grandmother's stove. And I just knew that this was the lifelong path that I was going to take. It was not like that. I started watching cooking shows. There's a great show. You can find it on YouTube. It's called Great Chefs of the World. And it is so low budget. It is not impressive production wise, but there's a really calming quality about it. You know, I think there's calming qualities about cooking shows out now, but I also think that they're meant to generate feeling and excitement and nervousness. This was just calm.
Yeah.
Maybe in the same way, like Great British Bake Off is just for me, calm. And so I would watch the chefs cook. And I think that I have an ability to learn how to do a task by watching someone else do it. So if there's like an actual thing, painting, woodworking, building a table, whatever, if I watch enough videos, I might not do it well, but I can do it and I can get pretty dang close. And so that's what happened with cooking, is I just zoned in on this like methodical process of creation. And I was preoccupied with being a kid and figuring myself out and being an angsty teenager and then trying to figure out where I wanted to go to school, that like cooking was there, but it wasn't the forefront. And then it wasn't until a year of failed international business and economics at a university, at Grand Valley State University in Allendale, Michigan, that I was like, wow, I'm unhappy. This is so bad. I'm bad at it and it sucks. And my mom was like, well, why don't you try culinary school in Chicago? And I went the 2-year program and then just kind of started taking off from there.
That's quite the suggestion for your mom to make at that point, too. You know, usually if you go to school for a semester, did you literally fail out on that?
No, I didn't. Well, I was failing classes. Mm. I was not asked by the university to leave. I left on my own accord.
Yeah, well, they want that tuition, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
You got to get that. I feel like now it's very much so like, go to trade school, don't go to college. There's that sort of thing has become a bit louder and louder in the past few years. But that...
Oh, I graduated high school in 2002.
Okay, yeah. So that wasn't the time that parents were like, you know, don't go to college. That was very against the grain. I mean, that's a cool mom move right there, you know?
Huge, huge. And I think that she just noticed how unhappy. And if when you are unhappy, it is likely that you're not going to, like, there's no way my life is going to be off to a great start. And she was like, well, anything can be better than what's happening now, which she was right.
Right. That's really cool. And did your dad, was he... in the mix?
Oh, my dad is a man of few words, but like fiercely, fiercely loyal to whatever I want to do. So he's going along with it. He's like, cool, great. You know, my mom taught child psychology. My dad is an engineer. My brother is an engineer. And then, you know, for my entire family to just, you know, see my lack of enthusiasm for life, it was like, let's like push her into wherever she needs to go.
Right, right. Yeah. No, 1,000%. It's too long of a road to hate it that much.
You're listening to Lake Air, WLAK, Amory's home for Up North News Radio.
ABC News, I'm Dave Packer. Sirens sounded in Tel Aviv today as the city came under a Hamas rocket attack. Police say four girls between the ages of 9 and 17 watching a movie Saturday evening at an AMC theater in Braintree, Massachusetts, when a man wearing a blonde wig rushed into the theater without paying, stabbed the girls without warning. Witness Mateo Rojas.
They were in a daze, needless to say, very traumatized and definitely wanted to have their privacy head down, but at least they were talking and were engaged with the EMT, so that was relieving to see.
The suspect in custody may be linked to two stabbings at a McDonald's in Plymouth, Massachusetts, and a homicide in Connecticut. Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has accepted a nomination to be among those vying to be the Libertarian Party's presidential candidate, who will be chosen this afternoon at the Libertarian National Convention in Washington. A day after the PGA Tour announced a 30-year-old golfer Grayson Murray died, his family announcing the cause of death, suicide. This is ABC News.
You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram.
A series win in Boston. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports from Fenway Park in Boston, where the Brewers beat the Red Sox again, this time 6-3. Joey Ortiz with a two-run double in the third to kick off a five-run rally. And for the second day in a row, the Brewers used Jared Koenig as a starter for just the first or second inning. Lefty against left-handed batters in the Red Sox lineup. How rare is that? Brewers manager Pat Murphy.
I think it happens a lot. You know, a starter gives you a good start and a reliever comes in and gives you an inning and a third. We just did it reverse. Mm-hmm. So I don't think it's like a magical plan that everybody has kind of the same plan, you know. Using an opener is not anything new.
The Brewers had a no-hitter going with Colin Ray until the seventh, so they win the series, game three, today at Fenway. Then they return back to Milwaukee, where they take on the Cubs for a four-game series beginning on Monday, Memorial Day. The final, 6-3, Brewers over the Red Sox. From Fenway Park, Boston, with sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
Enjoying this local program? Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. We'll see some shower chances for today. There could be some heavy rainfall at spots. Otherwise, we'll see highs in the lower 60s. Southeast winds will turn to the northeast. Tonight, skies will turn mostly clear, lows dropping to the upper 40s. It's 60 at our studios.
Earl Ingram.
Susan from Kenosha. Good morning to you, Susan. You say what?
I've been marching since I was 17. I'm 74. And women need to get out. You need to vote because you don't want to go back to 1950 where you weren't allowed a credit card, where you weren't allowed to purchase a car or a home. These are things that are at stake.
The Earl Ingram Show, weekday mornings 8 to 10 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
Todd Albaugh.
Hey, everybody, join us next time for a special Memorial Day show as we have on Jeremy Lyon from the Department of Veterans Affairs and looking back at Gold Star families.
The Todd Albaugh Show, weekdays noon till 2.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Without further ado, back to my conversation with Kristen Kish. When you got into school, were you like, this is awesome right away? Or was there a big learning curve there too? Did you question that?
You know, I think I was questioning everything at that time. I was, I'm happily married to my wife and been out since I was like 28. So 12 years. But at the time I was very much in the closet and struggling with my own identity and not just sexual identity, but just identity at large.
Yeah.
And so I knew I was good at school. I would thrive when I was when I walked in those doors, but the second I would leave, I would feel lost again. And, you know, there's not one way to figure yourself out. You just kind of go through it and hopefully you have a great support system, which I did. And it took me years. I left Chicago because my parents said, we will no longer support a child who is not willing to work. And it's not that I wasn't willing to work. I just felt like, and I was so insecure that taking a job that was below executive sous chef, which I was not qualified for, was not an option for me. And so for a while I was like, no, I'm not going to take that job. I'm not going to take a cook job. I'm not going to do that. And my parents, who were graciously paying for my really nice apartment in the West Loop, were like, you're done. You're done. And they put me on a train from Chicago back to Kalamazoo, where they picked me up and drove me back to Grand Rapids and was like, figure your shit out. You got to figure it out, because this is not how this is going to work. So no, it took me some time.
So did you then like start working in a kitchen? Do you work your, what was your first gig out of school?
So I was working at it was called the Union League Club of Chicago. And it was like this kind of ritzy, like buttoned up, hoity-toity kind of place, but I like made egg salads for the buffet and like whatever. I also loved, I dabbled too much in drugs and alcohol to calm my own social anxiety. And so I did that job and then I refused to take any other job, went back to Michigan. My parents were like, no more. For 4 months, I lived on my pajamas because I was so depressed. And they were like, well, okay, clearly you're not going to thrive at home with your parents. So maybe you get one more shot. We're going to help you out for like 3 weeks, go somewhere, get a job, just get any job and we'll help you. And I did, I moved to Boston, got a line cook position for like $8 an hour or whatever. And I really, then I started to like understand what it means to own a craft and to develop yourself personally. So that's what I started to do. And it just like, that job in Boston, I will say Boston, I think was the healthiest place of my life, where I just kind of like, I did what I needed to do in order to not have to move back home. And one job led to the next. And eventually I found working for this woman. She's the one who put me up for Top Chef, because I was like, I'm not doing that. And I'm not going on TV. And you are out of your mind if you think that I'm going to thrive in this. I am socially anxious. I have deep-seated like anxiety, new situations in the unknown put me into a tailspin. So no, I'm not going on television. She said, you have to. And I was like, she's like, we need more women on television. And I was like, oh, and I don't know. It was a combination of timing. I don't know, maybe catching me off guard that all of a sudden I was like, sure, I'll take the first call. And I took the first call. I kept saying yes and yes and yes. And all of a sudden I ended up on the show.
Wow. So you like, it sounded like you had all this anxiety and this no energy when it was like for you, but when it was like for the greater like thing of more women on TV, that's what clicked and you said yes.
Yeah, I needed a larger purpose outside of myself. And, you know, to say like, of course I went on TV, obviously to fuel some sort of my own being, of course.
Yeah.
But it just, when I clicked into the perspective of what that actually meant, I was like, okay, I see. Like, at least it gives me something to focus on that's outside of my own, you know, head.
Right. And has the anxiety been a thing that stuck with you since childhood, since you can remember, or did it come on at some age?
It started to come. I was like really shy and I'm very introverted. And I think what happened was when my life started becoming more guest facing, it was like kind of triggered on like a larger level. Now I'm like, oh, wow. Like there's no wall between me and whoever is going to judge me. I also was trying to not judge myself as harshly as well. So like that comes from, you know, there's a lot of like personal development happening at the same time. But I think in a lot of ways it accelerated when I became more available to strangers and people and their judgment. So I'm protecting my own little bubble, but all of a sudden, you know, now you're on TV. Or now you're going into the dining room when you're normally, you know, comfortable in the kitchen. Now you're sitting at a table with people you just met with cameras, judging the sink on this big show. And then you're like, holy shit. But I did a lot of work. I do a lot of mind work. So I do on public speaking.
Sorry. I talked over you because I'm a terrible host. You did hypnosis, you said?
I did. Yeah.
Cool. What's that like?
It is so good. It's like a form of therapy that I had never experienced before. And before Top Chef, like I had done great. Like I had several shows before Top Chef and I'm fine. Like I can get through it, but how I want to feel getting through it is what I wanted to change for Top Chef. And I was like, I want to be present. This is a huge thing in my life. I'm excited to do it. And I want to be present with every single day. And so in order to do that, I had to calm my anxieties. And the way I explain, you know, I think some people who don't know what anxiety feels like, they're like, oh, it's this bullshit thing that you made up in your head. And I'm like, no, it's actually a real thing because it goes from nerves to anxiety, which the way I describe nerves, you're very present in your body. You're kind of, you're there. Anxiety to me is all of a sudden my body is present, but my mind is already over in the corner, like already running away. And I'm like, it's like focusing on something that hasn't even happened yet.
Yeah.
Panic. Panic is when your mind and your body go so far out that you can't reel it back in. And I was toggling between anxiety and panic in some instances. And I was like, I can't do that anymore. I really can't. And so hypnosis is like a, you know, it's a little bit of talk therapy. It's a little bit of you just literally laying there and just zoning out. You don't have to do anything. It's not like you snap your fingers and someone's going to make you bark like a dog. It's not anything like that. Right. It's about reprogramming your subconscious mind with its 88 to 90% of our daily actions. Think about that. Isn't that wild?
That is wild.
Because it's in the same way that our body knows how to breathe without us being conscious about breathing. Our actions are also doing the same thing.
And we don't even know what's in our subconscious.
I'm talking correct because all those stories are starting from when you were a kid.
Yeah. And then because a lot of your childhood, you forget.
You know?
Or you're walking down the street. You're like, oh, was that a childhood or a dream? Either way, it's real to me, though. So,
yes. And it forms our behaviors. And so I learned a lot of it because my wife, who's been in food and beverage for a very, very long time, she recently started her own business, whatever. She does all hypnosis, emotional freedom technique, breath work. I do not use my wife as my therapist. I use a different, but she's the one who kind of started to teach me about how powerful it can be to tap into your brain.
That's really cool. Yeah. That's very cool. And I can only see, I've done some of that throughout my years and very on and off, you know, like do it when it gets to a point where you really need some. It'd be better to do it just consistently when you're not waiting for that. But come on, I'll get there when I get there. But it's cool to see that. And you have found that for the first season, did you find yourself present most of the time? Can you say that?
I found myself present 99% of the time. The 1% in which that I'm going to be working on going into next season is what true social anxiety is being amongst a large group of people that you don't know, large or small, I guess, doesn't matter. But you know, when we sat down at the table and in my ear, they say, all right, Kristen, go ahead, like greet the table. And I had no plan going into any of these things. And I was like, I'm just going to wing it. I can do this. I can't do that. You start looking around and you feel everyone looking at you. And then all of a sudden you're just like, oh my God, what if I don't say something smart enough? What if I'm not like witty or charming, or what if I say something wrong? And all the things start to go, and then you kind of just don't say anything of interest. You're kind of like, just like, welcome. I want to do something more with that. And that is what I'm working on. But like in terms of my anxieties about my worth and if I'm doing a good job, I've tackled and will continue to maintain that. It's about now just like the pure social anxiety of sitting at a table with strangers.
I see what you're saying. Yeah. Cause like when you do that, it's almost like improv a little bit of like, how do you release? Cause I guess I've done that improv and stand up and stuff. And in improv, it's just new moment, every moment being in the thing, like however you say it, it doesn't matter. Yes. And every situation, just go with it kind of a thing. So you're almost like, is that kind of like what you want? Like to like feel more free in these like sort of traditional hosting things?
Yeah. Like I think that there's a layer of details, because it's, you know, television. I have to say what I'm going to say, but no one can react back. Like no one can talk back to me. They can react in their face, but like that's when you get in trouble of like talking above each other and over each other. Yeah. And there's this like, you know, not every table is different or the same. Every table is different with different people that have something different to say. And at the end of the day, I just need to welcome everyone and kick it off.
Right.
That's it.
Yeah.
And I overthought it every single
It's so fun to overthink things. I do it all the time. I have to do some shout outs sometimes, and I'll take it like 15 different times.
I'm
like,
yes.
Why am I doing it? But I'm like looking at myself, judging myself.
We're having this conversation for, I don't know how long it's been now, but largely you're asking me questions, but normal, whatever I would, you know, we'd having an equal back and forth conversation, which I can do.
Right.
It's you know, like you're saying, when you have that line that you have to hit. Oh my God, I've done it so many million times. They're like, hey, can you make a video for such and such? And you're like, cool. All you got to say is, hi, I'm Kristen Kish. I really look forward to you watching Top Chef tonight at 9 p.m. Do it over and over and over again. You're like, I don't want it anymore.
Those are the worst. I just did it for a show that I'm doing, and I literally did it 5 times. And my whole team is like, it's fine. It's fine. It's like, yeah, it's stupid. You know? And then it's just like, I don't know, some inner child thing in your head.
But I do want to ask you, when you talk about improv, just like any skill, you have to hone it and you become better and better and better at it. But where do you, in your brain, do you start? Or like give yourself permission.
I'm sorry, what did you just say?
Or like give yourself permission to not control what you're about to say.
Yeah, I think it's very much so in free association. And improv is a game with other people, you know, where you like, you almost start with games like zip, zap, zoom. Yes. And like, there's no denying anything somebody says, like you just say, yes, that is a beautiful pink elephant. And I want to find it a beautiful pink bear because I think elephants and the other person would be like, yes, because elephants and bears, we all know love. All of that stuff I'm saying is stupid and means nothing, but it's just getting into the programming of saying everything that's given to you as a gift, see what you can do with it, you know, and in hosting, which I've done, and keep in mind, I'm not great at either improv or hosting necessarily.
I would argue that, but sure.
well, that's kind. But, you know, so sometimes those improv rules of where everything can be zany and wild need to be dialed in a little bit. But what improv does is it turns the dial all the way over to whatever the hell, just so you stop caring. Especially when you do improv on stage, it can get really bad really quick. I've been involved in some terrible improv shows in my life, but it's kind of the same thing as bombing in stand-up comedy, which is an integral part of learning how to be a stand-up. You care less when you bomb, and therefore caring less and dying a million deaths on stage then allows you to care less in smaller scenarios. And also just what care less means is just allows you to free yourself up, so you're not thinking about it, so you are in the moment.
So like, you know, like when you bomb on stage,
yeah,
you've already did it. You know what it feels like.
Yes.
So you kind of care less because you've already been there and you're not worrying about it happening for the first time.
That, and you're also like, I know how to get out of this. Like, if I bomb, I know how to climb out of this. This
well, is a well. How do you get out of it?
Oh, bombing? Oh, yeah. Well, you just, the simple ways you address the truth. Like, well, I've had better days up here. How are you doing? You liking the show? I mean, I'm a professional. Can you believe that? You know? And then almost make it about, I usually acknowledge the truth that it's not going well. And I don't bomb completely anymore, thankfully. Maybe I will in the future. But I usually will bomb a joke or a bit, or like 5 minutes will go by. I'll be like, oh, what the hell's going on? And then I'll turn to the audience and almost make it about them, do a little crowd work, see what I can get, or just go to a bit that I know always works, get myself out of it, kind of a thing. So you find these different, it's almost a process of like something on your car breaks, you know how to fix it.
I will keep that in mind.
yeah. But if you ever want to riff on that stuff, yeah, let me know. Because it's even finding like an improv. That's the tough thing, too, about like you're now the host of Top Chef. You may have an interest in getting in on improv. Where do you even go to do that where you're like, you also may not feel like people are looking, you know, at you in some way?
I would use the idea of improv as a therapy session, more of like a one-on-one for me.
Got it. One-on-one improv.
Doing That's it good. Out in the world.
Yeah.
But it sounds therapeutic in a lot of ways.
It is. Yeah. It just allows you to free up, Yeah. It's fun. Super fun. Hey, I got a little self-help question for you. For me, what are the essentials that a guy like me, 30, almost 37 years old, which is a little crazy to say, I'm going to be honest with you. A lot of the kitchen supplies went away in the divorce. All right. There was not an equal split of the kitchen. So I've got 3 samurai swords on my wall, but 1 butter knife. What are some essentials that I need to make my kitchen a thing that at least gives me a shot?
My first question would be, do you actually enjoy cooking?
I enjoy when I fish, catch a fish, clean the fish, cook the fish. I enjoy it. Right. Hunting the same. Usually it's, I got to be in on the process and nobody else is going to do it. So I just do it. And when I do it, I do have some joy in it. Now that said, largely when it comes to cooking, I'm like, God, I don't have time for that. Let me just like blend a bunch of stuff. I literally have a bullet blender. I just put all the stuff that I'm like, yeah, this will make me not die today. Drink it, done. So, but I would like to find more joy in cooking, but sure. I need like ease me up.
I will say you got to start where your starting line is. Like I could recommend, oh, like this great new knife is going to get you excited, but you're probably going to end up putting it on your wall with your samurai sword because you're like, I'm not using it. Or, you know, recommend this great pot that's really wonderful for cooking specific things. And you're like, yeah, not for me. I heard you like the grill, right?
Yeah.
So it's not about building. I mean, you can build things that you aspire to be, but not everyone has to love cooking, and that's okay. You know, you're a hunter, you're a fisher. It's building things around those practices that you probably already have a great wooden cutting board, but is it big enough to throw a whole venison on it? I don't know. Is that something you do? I don't know. But if it is, like, make your workplace special.
Yeah.
Work for what you're going to do. A great boning knife, great fillet knife. Someone that, you know, hunts and fishes. Do you have a vacuum sealer? And have you heard of sous vide? Do you have that stuff?
My grandpa had a vacuum sealer. It's somewhere in the garage. I got to go find it. Because you're right. Yeah, I'm usually just, if I catch enough fish, I usually do it up north with my family. And I just clean and then they take it. But if you catch enough, keeping it for a long time is great, you know?
When you vacuum seal, you're kind of already halfway to what they call sous vide, which you hear a lot of fancy restaurants do, right? So within that vacuum seal, instead of packing 10 fish, so fillet, instead of packing 10 fillets in there, get smaller bags and pack maybe 2 or 3, right? Before you seal that bag up, add chunks of butter, throw some whole fresh herbs, some peppercorns, a little bit of lemon zest, olive oil, then seal it up. Then from there, what you can do is either freeze it, and then when you're ready to eat it, you get this tool that you can attach to any pot. You can attach it to back your toilet, any body of water like that that contains, and you set it to, you know, you can find it online, different temperatures for different proteins, and you literally just set it like a bathtub. And when it's ready, you put that bag in that you've already vacuum sealed, that you're used to practicing that anyways, and you let it go.
Oh, wow.
You are sous vide. You open up that bag, throw it on a plate, add some vegetables or another blended nutritional thing, and call it a day.
That's awesome.
You're already playing into the things that you know how to do.
Yeah. Yeah, that's really cool right there.
So I would do a little home vacuum sealer and what they call a sous vide thing. It's like a stick that just regulates water temperature.
Oh, cool. And yeah. You can heat up plastic like that and you don't like it. It's not weird or you don't need it.
So you need actual like vacuum sealed sous vide bags. Like they're thicker.
Okay.
You can cook them. You don't cook at high temperatures. So when you do this. So I'm sure there's some health guru out there that's probably like, never heat your plastic. But I'm like, I also grew up eating TV dinners in the microwave.
Right.
Whatever. This is less worse than that.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I would definitely recommend it. I will make sure that you get like a little link or something of what I'm talking about.
I appreciate that. I wanna tell you one other thing I can cook, and I wanna ask if you've had it. Have you ever had a grilled peanut butter and jelly sandwich? Isn't that the best thing in the world?
And the peanut butter melts and it just kind of like drips out the side and it's just less claggy in your mouth. And it is so good. But do you do grape or strawberry or something different?
So I don't really, my mom used to make them growing up. And yeah. I was never a choices kid. It was never like, you know, we got this or this. It's like, we got this. So I'm an equal opportunity jelly or jam user. I don't even know the difference.
Also, you know what you can do to level up that, to put it in your kitchen? They call it, my wife is Australian. And so in Australia, they have these things called toasties. And I was like, it's just kind of like a grilled cheese, isn't it? She was like, yes, but no. So, you know, the George Foreman grills, it kind of looks like that.
It's a camper thing, right?
Yeah, where it seals the edges.
Yeah, and you put it over the campfire?
You can do that or get one that sits on your countertop.
Okay.
So that's electric. But you basically fold your sandwich, you put it in there, clamp it shut, and then when the light turns green, you have a sealed like pocket. It's like it's making its own little mini hot pocket.
Oh,
and
God. So
in Australia, they do... baked beans from the can, or they do spaghetti,
like
put it in there with a pat of cheese and you clamp it down and it comes out as like this melty, cheesy, delicious thing. Or you can do peanut butter and jelly sandwiches.
See, that's great. And that's easy too. And I think that's the thing, like finding things like that or the bags. I mean, that's helpful because a big issue, I think, with me with cooking is like, you got to plan ahead a little bit. Like if I walked into my place and I have like bison, that a buddy of mine is a bison farmer. He gave me a bunch of bison, but I'm always like, I can't just pull it out of the freezer and eat it that day. You know, I got to unthaw it. And right. So I'm always late to the game. I got to think ahead a little. So anything where I don't have to think ahead, like I like freezing a bunch of stuff and then just pulling it out and blending it and doing it on that day. So I got some work to do, but planning, I think, is a big thing for me.
Plan ahead and also just give yourself permission to get whatever, like the things that I've mentioned, get the things that meet you to what's going to fit your lifestyle. Because really, that's what it just needs to be in order to be sustainable.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Well, these were really great tips and just a lot of fun here. Thank you so much for coming on. And I got to ask you, is there anything I didn't ask you that you're like, yeah, idiot, you should have asked about this?
No. This was great. I have so like my brain is just like still reeling about all the things that you need in your kitchen that makes your life easier. I'll pull together a list for you.
Oh, that would be great.
And when I come to Wisconsin next, I would love to go to a supper club.
Let's go to a supper club. I know plenty of them. Okay. Oh, and I'm going to make you an old fashioned. All right.
Okay. So with your brandy?
With my brandy. Yeah. Did we send you some brandy?
Yes, it's not in my house currently, but I think it's en route or at my
okay. PO box. All right. At the PO box or something. All right. Are you a brandy person?
I am any alcohol in small quantities person.
Okay. Yeah, you can have a small quantity.
I'm a taster. I'm not a drinker.
Okay. Did you enjoy tasting the old fashions in Wisconsin?
I will say one of
you're listening to Lake Air 1260 AM WLAK Amory and 107.5 FM W298 DK Amory and always streaming on the Civic Media app.